Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We're your hosts, Matt Levine
and Vincent Hanna.
And we're talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts, welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the bio.
According to museum security, you were the last one to leave last night. Did you see or hear anything strange?
Well, I thought I heard something as I was leaving, but it could have been anything.
Sweeping teams of two. Nobody goes in alone. This place is not going to open until every room is clear. I'll go.
Come out, wherever you are.
Any idea about a weapon?
Something big.
The board is hosting a gala preview here tomorrow night. It would be a disaster for us if we had to postpone.
We may have somebody on our hands who makes Jeffrey Dahmer look like a Cub Scout.
You have to let the gala go on. Something's wrong.
Come on, what's the matter with you?
The Relic.
How you doing, Vincent?
Oh, I'm good. I've been watching some good scary movies. You'll like this. I have finally started the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
My favorite series.
I know. And I've seen the first one a few times, so I skipped that. I went straight to two, which I know is high on your list.
Yes, it is. That's my favorite of the series and one of my favorite 80s horror movies for sure. Maybe just horror movies in general. That's become kind of legendary as like, you know, a thinly veiled story about a young gay man who's struggling to kind of like come to grips with his identity and come out of the closet and kind of just understand his own sexuality. But it's also a great Nightmare on Elm Street movie. So I really love the second movie in that series.
I really would like to consider that movie for an episode of Camp Kaiju because of those themes, but also there is some imagery in that movie that just really kind of warped my brain. I was like, what is happening? And if it foreshadows the rest of the series, I'm all for it. But there were some messed up things.
Yeah. I often think about the like hell dogs or like devil yes. dogs or whatever you like at towards the end. Those are terrifying.
And like, I don't know. The only thing I'm going to say is I really didn't know when the movie was in a dream or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still thinking about that.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, is that a perfect example of the unreliable narrator? Or is it just a really poorly made movie? I don't know. I keep thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would like to believe it's intentional and, you know, kind of blurring the lines between reality and a dream state. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly a debate to be had about that. But I do love that movie. And the most of the rest of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies are like really clever, very surreal and strange. Definitely my favorite horror movie franchise.
All right. Well, we'll get it on Camp Kaiju for sure at some point.
Cool. I can't wait.
All right. How are you?
Pretty good. Yeah, I mean, it's October, my favorite month of the year. An excuse to watch at least one horror movie a day, which is always fun. So that's been good. I've been trying to see a bunch of stuff in theaters. Some good stuff is out there right now. The change of the seasons, I'm a little under the weather, but I mean, it's October. There are horror movies out there. Everything is good. All is right with the world.
Nice.
So thanks for hanging out, friends. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Please rate and review Camp Kaiju wherever you listen. You can also send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com. You can leave comments on our Facebook page or our Instagram page at camp_kaiju. Or if you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. The creepier the message that you leave for us, the better. So please don't hold back.
We're going to feature our Patreon, our patron Sean's kaiju hotline voicemail later this episode. When he's talking about walking down the street with some shadows following him. Very creepy.
Man, can't wait.
Whoa.
Sorry. For people, well, this probably won't be in the episode. Vincent's screen has, like, it just kind of went topsy-turvy and it really caught me off guard. So everything's, we're in the upside down here on Camp Kaiju tonight. Okay. Stranger Things reference.
Yeah, sorry, everybody. I'm just messing with my background. Matt, continue, please.
All right. Finally, please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more reviews and special content. Coming up in the month of October, we'll probably have some more reviews, maybe even a list or two on there, so make sure to check that out. And finally, please become a patron at patreon.com/campkaiju. For discounts, priority comments, and access to any live events. Thank you so much to all of our current patrons, Jason, Chris, Sean, Peggy, and our anonymous patron. We really appreciate you. Anybody else out there, if you'd like to become a patron yourself, we do have some occasional kind of promotions and kind of extra goodies that you get. So check it out.
Yeah.
So yeah, what's going on since last time at Camp Kaiju when we talked about Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton 2001 movie? One thing that I found out today is that Mel Gibson is in a new monster movie and it's supposed to be terrible.
Is it just a biography?
It certainly could be. I would, you know, that might be a more interesting movie, but this one is called Monster Summer. It's getting terrible reviews. But I'm really intrigued by it. I would kind of like to see it. Can't really find a synopsis, but it's a new Mel Gibson monster movie and it's supposed to be bad. And I think that's kind of amusing. So who knows? Maybe I'll watch it. Maybe not. Probably not. But that's out there. All right. It won't take very long. Here's the synopsis of Monster Summer starring Mel Gibson. When a mysterious force begins to disrupt their big summer fun, Noah and his friends team up with a retired police detective to embark on a monstrous adventure to save their island. Like I said, supposed to be bad. Mel Gibson is in it. If that sounds intriguing to you, check it out.
Okay.
What else do we have going on?
Well, you saw The Substance.
Yes, I did, which is definitely a monster movie that is firmly in the monster movie genre. It's really good. There are some things I didn't like about it. Just a quick sort of description of the movie, which played at film festivals earlier this year and got a lot of publicity. It won Best Screenplay at the Cannes Film Festival. So the idea of the movie is that Demi Moore plays a kind of aging celebrity. She finds out about this new kind of black market drug that supposedly unleashes a new, better you. So she tries out this drug. The less you know about what happens after that, the better. So I won't reveal anything else, but it is extremely gory. Really disgusting, very funny, over the top. It's, you know, some of the themes seem a little bit obvious, like kind of Hollywood's obsession with like youth and beauty is maybe not the most mind-blowing theme of all time, but this movie approaches it in just such an incredible, provocative, over the top way. Definitely highly recommended, especially if you love monster movies and you don't mind just gallons of gore and some gross out horror. Check it out for sure. It's one of a kind.
The smile on your face as you talked about all of that, I wish listeners could see.
Yeah, it's I mean, I'm thinking about like the last 10 to 20 minutes of the movie in particular when like everything goes crazy. And yeah, I won't ruin it from there, but check it out for sure.
Okay. You also saw Megalopolis. Not a monster movie, but just tell me about it.
I love Megalopolis. I know it's divisive. I know it's gotten some bad reviews, but I Francis Ford Coppola, late in his career, obviously, but he invested so much of his money into this project and it attempts to be kind of like, you know, the fall of the American Empire as if it were ancient Rome, sort of like mirroring that story a little bit. So it's very political. It's really over the top. It's stunningly beautiful, ambitious, creative, funny, at times intentionally funny, very often unintentionally funny, but you know, it's definitely a flawed movie, but despite its flaws, I just haven't seen an American film in particular over the last several years that is so alive and filled with ideas and unique and like clearly the expression of like an artist who's trying to say something, you know? So whatever its flaws, Megalopolis is amazing. I've seen it twice. I really love it. Yeah.
That's great. I have yet to see this movie, but I do love the idea of an artist and an artist's passion project. You know, damn the critics, damn the box office. You know, he probably knew the metrics weren't looking good, but I know he's been talking about making this movie for decades. Mm-hmm. And Coppola, you know, he does have some baggage with him. But regardless of his personal life, his place in cinema history is undeniable. Mm-hmm. And I'm just interested in, like you said, a late career work, whether it's from him or Scorsese or what Spielberg's doing now. It's mm-hmm. just like what these guys we've seen for like 50 years now. It's like, what are they saying in the twilight of their lives?
Yeah, I agree. It's fascinating to see that. I think like that has happened with other directors in the past. Like some of Hitchcock's later movies, like Frenzy, for example, are really fascinating. Billy Wilder, some of his later movies, like The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes and Avanti and Fedora. I believe that directors get more interesting as they age instead of less interesting. That's not true across the board, of course, but you know, this late career kind of like burst from Coppola is fascinating. I love to see it. It's great.
Yeah, totally.
That's highly recommended for sure.
Cool.
Aside from Nightmare on Elm Street, have you seen anything good?
I watched a new horror movie, which I don't often do. Unfortunately, I want to watch more new movies, but it's called Immaculate. Mm. It was released earlier this year. It stars Sydney Sweeney, and she's a nun. And without spoiling anything, she becomes immaculately with child.
Mm.
So there's like a mystery within the convent about how this happened. It is worth checking out. As you would say, it is messy.
Mm.
It is full of all the cliches of a nun horror movie. But, you know, the end left me thinking. I was like, huh, all right.
All right. Yeah, that's a good selling point. Good review. I'm intrigued to check it out. I like Sydney Sweeney. I haven't seen a lot of her stuff, but very compelling. I'm always up for a good like non-horror movie, so I'll check it out for sure.
Yeah, it's 90 minutes. So actually, it was a weirdly effective double feature with the second Nightmare on Elm Street. I watched them back to back.
Whoa.
Just like they both play with themes of unwanted presence within the body. So I was like, oh, there are some weird parallels here.
You just clinched it. I definitely want to see Immaculate now with that comparison. That sounds great. And, you know, like, you know, body horror and kind of like things like unwanted guests and stuff like that, like in your body or like in your home, in your space. Like, I'm always up for that theme. So it sounds great.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, so last time on Camp Kaiju, previously, there was a scratching at my door that we were convinced it was a fiend without a face or an ape from a planet beyond the stars. Turns out it was my dog that I had forgotten I had left on the porch. And I felt really bad at the end of our recording.
I love that. Yeah, when we recorded that episode, you were like, there is something outside of my house. It's trying to get in. And I had like, what's that? Sorry.
It freaked me out.
Yeah, it was freaking me out too. Like I had all these, you know, nightmarish visions in my head, but it turns out it was your dog, which is a fiend in a way, but not the kind of fiend that I was thinking of.
Had I actually opened the door, I would have been so relieved to see my dog.
I love that story. I like, in a way, I'm kind of glad that you didn't. So there was this like mystery for a little while, you know, like while we recorded, like it made it more interesting for sure.
Now we all know. Rest easy out there, folks.
It was only Ginger.
Yes. I also guested on another monster movie podcast called Monster Candy Podcast. I will link this episode in our own show notes, but they're a great gang of movie lovers over there, punk rockers, actually, with some pretty tight music. So anyways, we got connected on Instagram. They wanted me to help them discuss the Ray Harryhausen movie, Earth versus the Flying Saucers. And it's not a great movie, but I would say it's so bad that it's good. So check out that movie, but then listen to our conversation over at Monster Candy Podcast and give them some love.
I have not seen that movie or listened to that podcast episode yet, and I cannot wait to do both. So as soon as possible, I'm checking them out.
Yeah, not bad. We do have a few things coming up on Camp Kaiju. The Wolfman will be our next episode, followed by God Told Me To, and then Godzilla Minus One.
Yeah, some good stuff coming up. The Wolfman is classic. God Told Me To seems like kind of a weird, obscure cult movie by Larry Cohen. I know almost nothing about it, but I'm very excited for that. Godzilla Minus One will be fun to talk about. I feel like I'm slightly in the minority on that one. I don't love it as much as some other people do, but, you know, stay tuned for that episode. We'll dive in for sure. Another thing we should mention, Kris Kristofferson, rest in peace. We've lost some great actors and artists and filmmakers this year. Kris Kristofferson, one of the latest ones. You know, I can't think of too many monster movies that he was in, although he was in the Blade series, of course. So,
well, he was in Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, you're right. The one that we just talked about like 2 weeks ago. It's not very resonant in my mind, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, he really left an impression.
Yeah. I do love Kris Kristofferson. He's in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, some other really good movies. So rest in peace, Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah.
Real quick, we can talk about movies that came out in monster movie history around this time. The one that I'll shout out is one of my favorite horror movies of all time, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, released on October 11th, 1974. So that's about 40 years ago, pretty close to that. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's the question, is it a monster movie? Is it not a monster movie? Because it's a human serial killer and all that. But it is one of the best horror movies of all time. So Texas Chainsaw Massacre, 40 years ago, right around this time.
50 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. When I said that, I was like, is that math right? That doesn't sound correct. Usually I'm not terrible at math, but that was pretty bad. 50 years ago, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, and I have to shout out The Earth Dies Screaming, a movie from 1964 about killer robots. I love a good killer robot movie. It's a great sub genre of horror. So, The Earth Dies Screaming. I hope to find a trailer for that one for this episode.
Yeah, I mean, I'm intrigued by the title. It's directed by Terrence Fisher, who I think did quite a few Hammer horror movies. So I'm very intrigued. I would like to find out more about it for sure. Upcoming monster movie, Smile 2. Did you ever see the first Smile movie?
No.
I liked it. It has its flaws. I don't like the ending very much. And I think the sequel maybe will be not as good, but that's coming out pretty soon, October 18th.
Since we are talking about killer robots, there is a movie called Y2K that is being released in December. About the trailer looks pretty good. It's making the rounds on film and film festivals, but it's about a group of teenagers, partiers at they're having a New Year's Eve party on 1999 to 2000. So the Y2K scare that electronics would all go haywire. And in this movie, they do. And like toasters start killing people and it looks awesome. You know, total maximum overdrive, you know, so like I'm saying, it's a really fun genre, killer machines and robots.
Yeah. I don't really know that much about Y2K, the movie. That sounds pretty cool. I might have to check that out. But I agree about killer robots. We just talked about Chopping Mall in the last episode, which is a great killer robot movie. Maybe Y2K will live up to that movie's, you know, prestige, at least in my own head.
I hope so. I just love wackadoo movies like this coming out now, because I feel like they are a throwback to the 80s and these other earlier times when you just had so many like small crazy movies being released.
For sure, yeah. And one of my favorite things about the movie that we're talking about tonight is that it's kind of a fun throwback to like creature features from, you know, like the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, The Relic. Man, I feel like we've hardly mentioned it, but let's get to it.
Yeah, let's dive in.
We should be ruling the humans. These people are our food.
The world you live in is just a sugar-coated top.
There's a war going on out there.
This Friday, the age of man comes to an end.
Evil's greatest fear.
That must hurt.
Is our only hope.
There are worse things out than vampires.
Like what?
Like me.
Wesley Snipes, Stephen Dorff, Blade, rated R, starts Friday.
Someone is coming back to Elm Street. He is not friendly. He is not patient.
Kill for me.
And he is not a welcome visitor.
No! No!
But he has something terribly special for the new kid on the block.
It started to happen again.
Dad!
I'm in trouble. You've had some scary dreams, okay? Help!
Daddy can't help you now.
There's something inside him.
Fight him! You're not afraid of him. He doesn't even exist.
Freddy Krueger is back on Elm Street. Watch out for him. We'll be in your neighborhood soon. A Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 2.
You are all my children now.
Freddy's Revenge.
Suddenly, a man dies at the controls of a train. Suddenly, a car swerves to destruction. Suddenly, a plane dives to death. The Earth dies screaming. Suddenly, death descends on the four corners of the Earth, and only a handful of human beings survive to live in fear. Powerless to combat an unknown. The Earth dies screaming, and the robots take over.
Okay, my history with The Relic, like no history. It had been something I'd seen on my Hulu queue, and I'm like, yeah, that looks like something I'd be interested in. But leave it to Cam Kaiju to finally give me the excuse to watch it. So there's a lot I liked about this movie. There's some easy critiques to be made, but overall, I'm excited to dive into it.
Definitely, yeah. I have a similar history with this movie, although I did see it when it first came out. I think I must have seen it in the theater with my parents or something. They took me to a lot of movies when I was that age. I was around 13 years old when this came out. And then I totally forgot about it for, you know, like 20 or 30 years or whatever. My math is really bad tonight, man. I forgot about it for a very long time. And then I was just like flipping through the channels and a couple minutes of it were on TV. And I was like, oh, yeah, this movie. I totally forgot about this. I think most people have forgotten about this movie, but there's a lot that's fun about it. So I'm excited to talk about it, too.
It is a monster movie, like a legitimate monster movie. And I found that really fun, especially with it being made in the 90s. It's just like, it's a throwback movie, but it has such a 90s feel to it.
Yeah.
That I loved it.
Cool. Yeah. I'm happy to hear that. I mostly really loved it too. And it's set in a museum. It was shot at the Field Museum in Chicago, the Field Museum of Natural History. So that's a fun setting. Yeah. We'll dive in soon here, but, a fun late 90s creature feature.
Yeah.
Cool. So yeah, The Relic from 1997, like I said, directed by Peter Hyams. He was also the cinematographer. He did the cinematography on most of the movies that he directed, so kind of serving double duty there. He was a kind of a solid craftsman who did movies in a lot of different genres. Capricorn 1, a sci-fi movie, was one of his first hits that he directed. He also made 2010, the sequel to 2001: A Space Odyssey, which I think is pretty terrible, but some people like that movie. Maybe I'm unfairly comparing it to 2001. Peter Hyams also directed two Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, Time Cop and Sudden Death, which are both really fun. I love JCVD. I'm a big fan of Jean-Claude Van Damme. And those two, Time Cop especially, so entertaining. So yeah, Peter Hyams, not like an auteur, not a brilliant artist, but a lot of entertaining movies that he made over the years.
The film was written by Amy Holden Jones. Love a female screenwriter in this genre. John Raffo, Rick Jaffa, and Amanda Silver, based on the novel by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Amy Holden Jones had written and directed The Slumber Party Massacre, which I hear a lot in horror circles, and wrote movies like Love Letters, Indecent Proposal, and The Getaway.
The remake of The Getaway, I just wanted to point that out.
Okay, good, good, good. Jaffa and Silver are a husband-wife team who wrote and produced Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Ayo.
Yeah.
Several of its sequels in the reboot series. They also wrote Jurassic World and the Avatar sequel. Whoa. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, they have their hands in a lot of recent like franchises and like reboot series and stuff like that. Of course, we just talked about Rise of the Planet of the Apes on our last episode, and I'm excited to go into more of those movies. So I'll be, you know, intimately familiar with their work in the near future, hopefully.
Yeah.
The Relic was produced by Gail Ann Hurd and Sam Mercer. Kind of similarly to that screenwriting team that we were just talking about, they have their presence in a lot of very, very well-known monster horror thriller movies as well. Gail Ann Hurd produced The Terminator, Aliens, Alien Nation, The Abyss, Tremors, not to mention several sequels in those franchises like Terminator 2 and Tremors 2 Aftershocks, I think it's called. So yeah, she has produced a lot of monster movies over the years. Her producing partner on The Relic, Sam Mercer, produced movies like Congo, which is amazing, and I definitely hope that we talk about that on the podcast at some point. As well as several M. Night Shyamalan movies like Unbreakable, Signs, and The Village. So pretty good pedigree for the producing and writing team on this movie.
Okay, I mean, that all makes sense because these movies we mentioned, these producers and writers clearly understand the genre, which I get that watching The Relic. I know what they're doing. It leans into tropes, but in a really knowing way and effective way. It's good. Like, it's a solid movie. Okay, I won't get ahead of myself. creature effects are by Stan Winston, a legend in the industry. Really, really effective stuff. Again, I won't get ahead of myself.
Yeah, well, there will be a lot to talk about there for sure. This movie maybe does not do justice to those creature effects, but we'll talk more about that soon. So in the lead role, we have Penelope Ann Miller playing Dr. Margot Green, an evolutionary biologist. Penelope Ann Miller had her first big break on Broadway and has starred in many, many movies over the years, like Adventures in Babysitting, Kindergarten Cop, Chaplin, Carlito's Way, The Shadow, so on and so forth. The Relic was her first horror movie, and she said in interviews that she really enjoyed making it. She liked the character a lot. She thought it was a good, solid, scary movie. So her first experience with acting in a horror movie, and at least from her perspective, she really enjoyed it a lot.
Cool. Tom Sizemore's in this movie as Lieutenant DeGosta. DeGosta? Tom Sizemore is just one of those faces. He's just in a lot of different movies and TV. Born on the 4th of July, later, Point Break, True Romance, Heat, Saving Private Ryan, Bringing Out the Dead. So yeah, like tough guy roles, Tom Sizemore fits the bill.
Yeah, great character actor. And The Relic is one of the few times that he plays the male protagonist in the movie. So he's always a good presence, I think. He just died a couple years ago. So rest in peace to Tom Sizemore. But he's a lot of fun in this movie. In a supporting role, we have Linda Hunt as the movie or as the museum curator, Anne Cuthbert. She's mostly distinctive for her very short stature. She's been in a lot of movies and TV shows over the years. Currently, she's probably best known for having a supporting role in NCIS Los Angeles, but she's also been in Popeye, the original Dune, The Year of Living Dangerously. A familiar presence for sure. If you see her in this movie, you'll probably recognize her.
Yeah, she's fun. Another staple of 90s pop culture movies.
Totally.
How about James Whitmore? I knew he looked familiar. Was in Them.
Yeah.
40 Classic. Years prior. Yeah.
Yeah, I is sort of like you. I was like, where do I know that guy from? I've seen him in a movie before. And sure enough, yeah. Them, one of my favorite monster movies, James Whitmore plays one of the main characters.
Yeah, and he was also in the original Planet of the Apes, so we're bringing it back.
Yep, it all comes full circle on Camp Kaiju. I wish I could say that we planned that out, but in any case, it's a fun coincidence for sure.
Yeah.
The last cast member that I wanted to mention is Joffrey C. Brown. He has a very small role in this movie. He plays the security guard who is the first person killed in the movie. The only reason I think this is interesting is because he's also in Jurassic Park, and he's the first character killed in that movie as well. He's the animal handler who is killed by a velociraptor at the beginning of that movie. Kind of gives credence to the cliche from 1990s movies that the black characters are always the first to die. That's unfortunate. But it's kind of a cool connection that Joffrey C. Brown is in both The Relic and Jurassic Park. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, valid. That's good.
Yeah. Trivia. It's all about the trivia here.
Oh, I mean, what kind of movie podcast would we be if we didn't talk trivia?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of which, there are probably some good trivia facts in the production backstory of the film. Should we dive into that real quick?
Oh, yes.
So like we said before, the movie is based on a novel by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. That novel is set in the American Museum of Natural History in New York, where Preston was the public relations director. He seems to have maybe had some kind of beef in that position because the novel doesn't always portray museum management in the best light. So when they were working on this film adaptation, the museum would not allow the filmmakers to shoot in the actual American Museum of Natural History. They also said that they were a little bit worried about, a scary movie kind of like keeping kids away from the museum, which is insane. Like, you know, that would bring kids to the museum if like a horror movie is set there. So in any case, they didn't shoot the movie there. The producers kind of scrambled to find a replacement. And luckily the Field Museum in Chicago loved the idea and jumped at the opportunity for them to shoot the movie there. So that's where it's at.
Yeah, talk about publicity. Like, come on.
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't know, the museum setting is so fun in this movie, you know? Like, it adds to it so much. And I've never seen A Night at the Museum movies with Ben Stiller. I kind of assume they're terrible, but I sort of see The Relic is like a gory monster movie version of those movies, you know, like I think like maybe there's a similar appeal there. So I don't know. The Field Museum is definitely a major character in this movie and provides a lot of the fun to its kind of atmosphere, I would say.
How many movies have this setting? I will stand up for the first Night at the Museum.
Okay.
I've never seen the sequels, but, you know, it's one of Mickey Rooney's last roles, so he's just fun, and Dick Van Dyke, who's still alive.
Oh, and Robin Williams is in it too, right?
He's in the sequel.
Okay. All right, I take it back. I should see them before I talk trash about them, so I take it back. I'm sorry. Good to know that you like the first one. That's cool.
No, forget it. Just go watch Megalopolis again.
You know, I mean, like, we're equal opportunity. You can love Megalopolis and you can watch A Night at the Museum. It's all good. I'll see Megalopolis for a third time and then watch A Night at the Museum afterwards. It'll be a great double feature.
That you tell me about that.
My brain will explode afterwards.
What else? Well, the adaptation, did you just mention this? I don't know. The adaptation cuts out the book's main character, FBI agent Pendergast. But this is just kind of incorporated into the DaGosta character. So nothing really lost there. Mm-hmm. But let's talk Stan Winston and his crew. They made three versions of the creature, which is called the...
Oh, that could have been a trivia question if we had one on this episode.
Cthoga. It's a really cool name, Cthoga.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, the Cthoga. They made three versions of the Cthoga, with two people moving the head and several other crew members working the electronics to move the arms, claws, mouth, etc. The initial plan was to use more animatronics, but the short pre-production schedule forced them to use the man in a suit approach. The final design had a spider-like head and a 15-foot long body that was an amalgamation of a lion, an alligator, a horse, detailed with reptilian scales and tufts of hair down the spine.
So those practical creature effects are kind of combined with CGI. Whenever we see the creature in close-up, or if it's kind of, you know, supposed to be like lurking off camera or whatever, then it's usually the practical effects. If it's running, or if it's kind of like, it's mostly if it's running or if it's kind of moving quickly, then CGI is usually used instead. It really does seem like the creature was like the main hurdle in the production of this movie. Like, I couldn't really find out a lot about the rest of the making of the film, which I think kind of went, you know, just according to plan. But the creature was extremely difficult, very painful for the actors that were in the suit. It took a long time to get the look of it right. I found a lot of stuff just about the CGI that went into the making of it, and like all the different sort of like late 90s computer programs that they used to make it. I didn't think it was really maybe interesting to talk about on this episode, but it's definitely out there on the internet. And if you're into, you know, late 90s computer graphics and design, it was an ordeal for sure. They used like four different programs to like combine the like the rendering and the look and like the facial expressions and stuff like that. So whether or not those CGI effects hold up is another matter, but we'll talk more about that.
Yeah. And that just sounds exactly the kind of research I did with The Mummy from 1999, which is only 2 years later. But this technology that we take for granted now truly was still in its infancy. And visual designers were like both excited but also frustrated with the technology, because it was just like right there. They were so close to getting it to work perfectly. But it, like you say, it took a lot of tinkering to get something realistic.
Yeah. And just a lot of time and money too. Like, this movie was supposed to come out in 1996, and then they had to delay that almost a year just because the computer effects took so long. So
wow.
I have a habit of like bad mouthing CGI, and I still hold firm to that point of view. But, you know, it's easy to forget that like there's so much innovation and so many artists that take part in that process. So I don't love CGI, but shout out to all the people who worked on the CGI in this movie. It sounds like it was a pretty difficult ordeal. Time for our sponsor break. On that note, before we go any further, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link is in the bio. Vincent, do we have anything fun in Mina's mailbox tonight?
Oh, we do. Fun, fun, fun. We have two comments. I'm gonna, since they're short, I figured I'd read both of them. These are both on our YouTube page, Mischief Tales, and they relate to Fiend Without a Face. So we have Ruffian Zion, and Ruffian Zion says, I saw this film when I was at school and loved it. I created a monster for my D&D campaign that was based on the mental vampires.
Cool. That sounds fun.
Mental vampires. So cool. We also have Paul Peretti on YouTube. And Paul Peretti says, one of my all-time favorite sci-fi movies.
It's good to hear. I mean, Fiend Without a Face, I'll stick up for that movie. I know we both rated it the same way, but I feel like we had slightly different reactions to it. I'm a big fan of it as well. I know you mostly were too, but with some reservations. I'm always happy to hear that people like Fiend Without a Face. I think it's really fun.
Yeah, no, in hindsight, like the Monster Candy podcast guys, they love that movie too. So it's like one of those things where now I wasn't familiar with the movie before, but now that I am, I'm hearing about it all the time. I'm like, oh, where was I for, 70 years?
Not in existence for most of that time. So you have a good excuse there,
Excuses.
But yeah, it has cult status, definitely.
Yeah. Thank you, Ruffian Zion. Thank you, Paul Peretti. Thank you all for writing in week in, week out. We appreciate it. And we love reading your comments and your thoughts. So keep them coming, and we'll keep featuring them on Menia's Mailbox.
And we also have a trivia question out there. There's still time to submit your answer to our trivia question that we gave you all in our Planet of the Apes episode. Here, I'm going to repeat the question for you all if you would like to participate. Planet of the Apes was nominated for 3 Razzie Awards. The film won 2 of them, Worst Remake or Sequel and Worst Supporting Actor. That award, Worst Supporting Actor, went to which member of the supporting cast of Planet of the Apes? That is our trivia question for Planet of the Apes. If you know the answer or you'd like to guess, please feel free to leave the answer on our social media pages or email campkaiju@gmail.com. We will announce the answer on our next episode about the Wolfman, so stay tuned for that.
Yes, for sure. Thank you, Matt, for refreshing us there. And now we're going to turn it over to Mr. Peter Lorre. He's going to talk about Metropolis, not Megalopolis, but I'm sure there's Coppola's pulling some of the same imagery, maybe? I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, there are definitely like explicit references to Metropolis, including like one little dance that like the robot Maria does in Metropolis that also is kind of like repeated in Megalopolis. So I'm not going to nerd out about Megalopolis too much, but that's one of many, many fun things about that movie.
Well, I don't think Peter Lorre will nerd out about Metropolis. I've heard he's not having a great time in the recording booth. He keeps scratching at the door. I'm like, Peter, we give you food, we give you water. What else do you need?
Yeah, he has his bucket of fish heads in there. Like, just be content. That's all you need. Maybe someday he'll break out of there, but I kind of doubt it. I don't think it's ever going to happen.
He must fulfill the contract for season 4, and then he's free to do whatever he wants. But
oh, don't say that. We need him for the next couple seasons at least.
Well, okay, you bring it up. Between you and me and you listeners, I am in talks with Bela Lugosi.
Whoa, that's miraculous.
Yes, he's trying. It's his comeback tour. We're just trying to see. He wants it. He wants us. He came to us. And I was like, okay, I saw your last movie. I'll throw you a bone.
Yeah. How can you say no to Bela Lugosi? He's, synonymous with classic horror. You have to.
He might do something with like Poverty Row horror films.
Man, I can't wait. I feel bad for Peter. I hope he breaks out of that recording booth at some point because, it cannot be fun in there. So we'll have to see what happens with Peter and Bella coming up soon.
Yeah. Well, for now we've got Metropolis to hear from. So, it'll be a good time.
Cool. I can't wait.
Before Karloff and Lugosi stalked the screens, the movies were no less monstrous. These frightful figures lurked in the expressionistic shadows and danced in the macabre moonlight. Oh, they laughed, they cried, they fooled the sensibilities of honest, decent folk. In the age of silent pictures, these gruesome ghouls nonetheless cried out with a savage humanity that took the breath from all who witnessed their devilish delights. For in the silence, no one can hear you scream. You know, Pierre, this bucket of fish heads isn't so bad. Perhaps I should be more civil with Matthew and Vincent. Perhaps if I extend the olive branch, they may be more amenable to my desperate situation. For it is not the infernal recording booth that upsets me so, but rather the lack of human connection. No offense, Pierre. But do you hear me, my captors? Matthew, Vincent, I throw down the bucket of fish head gauntlet and I say to you, come and visit me sometime, and you shall have a fish head for yourself. Oh, this is some good food. Well. Damen und Herren, welcome to Silent But Deadly, where I, Peter Lorre, review monster movies from the silent era with the supreme pleasure. I positively relish my summoning from the spirit world to willingly lend my voice to a podcast. This week, we discuss Metropolis from director Fritz Lang, who might be just as well known for his films M and the Dr. Mabuse series. Metropolis was made in Germany during the Weimar period. It is set in a futuristic urban dystopia and follows the attempts of Freder, the wealthy son of the city master, and Maria, a saintly figure to the workers, who overcome the vast gulf separating the classes in their city and bring these workers together. With the film's often repeated message reads, quote, "The mediator between the head and the hands must be the heart." Metropolis is difficult to surmise in mere minutes. It is an epic science fiction film with elements of horror in the mad scientist Rotwang and his evil android mistress. The movie is cited among the most influential of all time, with its design elements appearing in other classics like Blade Runner, and Matthew's personal favorite movie of all time, Megalopolis. And while I may prefer my own feature with Fritz Lang, I cannot recommend Metropolis enough. Next time, we will discuss one more movie from Germany and the Expressionistic school. And considering it's Halloween, this one will be perfect. F.W. Murnau's other classic, Faust. I think I am getting good at this, Pierre. So good that Matthew and Vincent are bound to notice. They just have to. And if anything else, the bucket of fish heads will waft up the air vents into their nostrils and seduce them down below into the podcast booth.
From the gym one day, and I thought I was scared of my shadow, but then it wasn't my shadow, it was other shadows that were chasing me. Now, here's the thing. I came up with an idea, and I just wanted to run it by y'all to see what you think. So, now that I'm done with that voice. Anyways, hello, this is Sean from Toko for Two at Big Mac and the Fun Not Huge. Also, great patron supporter. I guess, maybe, I don't know. Anyways, I was coming home from the gym, and it was pretty late at night, and there were some shadows that were, I mean, I was tired as well, but there were some shadows that were coming around, And I started thinking, you know, this would be a really interesting time for a giant monster to just come out and start chasing after me. There's no other cars on the road. And I'm starting to think, huh, but what if that monster was attacked by another monster and I wasn't really paying attention about it? So I'm starting to think, what if I could come up with a short film idea of this guy who's just going about his business, not paying attention to anything, and as he's going home or going from destination to destination, he's being stalked by either giant monsters or other predators, and then these secondary giant monsters or other predators end up coming out and catching them instead of him actually being caught by any of these monsters. So it's like a chase sequence, but not really. I don't really know how to articulate it very well because I'm also really tired, but I just wanted to go ahead and see what you guys thought with that kind of idea where, you know, you could just play up something like that and maybe something to add on to it. Anyway, have a good time with your podcast, guys. Love hearing it.
Cool. Oh, I love it, man. Well, it's hard to get a clear vision of what he's talking about there, but I'm intrigued for sure. Kind of reminds me of the end of Jurassic Park where like the velociraptors are coming after the characters and then the T-Rex swoops in and like picks it up off the ground, you know?
Yeah. I love those moments where you're by yourself. Maybe you're in bed at night and you can't sleep, but your mind's just racing and you come up with these ideas for a movie or a TV show and you're like, oh, that's a good idea. And Sean, I do think that is a good idea, especially as a short film. I can see it. I can see someone having a lot of fun with the shadow work, especially.
Yeah, for sure. I think like whenever an idea like that gets into your head, like just write it, you know, even if you only start with like one scene or one idea, it can like expand in both directions from there. So take and run with it. I want to hear more, you know?
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Sean, for calling into the Kaiju Hotline. Listeners out there, we've had Naomi and Sean now 2 weeks running. Let's keep the Kaiju Hotline going.
Crank calls especially, please. I want to hear something.
Don't disappoint, Matt.
Let's get some crank yankers in here, you know?
All right. We're done.
It lives 50 feet beneath the streets. It's 36 feet long. It weighs over 2,000 pounds. And it's about to break out.
We're looking at the one who saw it. And it was big.
You said it was dark. Now, perhaps you were mistaken. A alligator half that size would starve in a week. No! He kept coming up with some garbage about alligators in the sewer.
Well, I've seen what this animal can do. You'd better take all the help you can get.
Alligator.
All right, so back to The Relic, our film that we're talking about tonight. Let's talk a little bit about the themes of this movie. And if there actually are themes in this movie, that might be the first question to answer. There are a couple. They're not especially deep. I'll just bring up one of them here real quick.
Yeah.
So superstition plays a pretty big role in The Relic. Mm. There's an entire museum exhibit that focuses on superstition throughout the world and in kind of historical cultures and stuff like that. So it's kind of, you know, right in the forefront there. Like superstition is a big part of this movie. The lieutenant character, D'Agusta, is very superstitious himself. He, you know, has this lucky bullet that he carries around with him at all times. He makes sure that he never steps over a corpse in a crime scene because he thinks that it's bad luck. He makes sure that, like, inevitably there's a moment where, like, a cat jumps out from, like, a shelf and scares somebody. And he makes sure that it's not a black cat, because that, of course, would be very bad luck. So, yeah, this theme of, like, science versus superstition is a pretty big part of The Relic. Because, of course, Dr. Green, the evolutionary biologist, is all about science. You know, any mystery can be explained by science, even if we don't quite understand the logic behind it yet. And that's a familiar trope from monster movies, you know, too many to list, really. Yeah, I don't know how much depth there really is to that. What do you think about that theme?
No, it's like so much of this movie, it is perhaps surface level, but it's effective. Like it provides a key conflict in the story. This conflict between our two leads, the male protagonist and the female scientist. So without it, I don't know what this movie would have as that driving force, that conflict.
Yeah, there needs to be some conflict between them to drive that relationship forward a little bit. It works pretty well in that context. It is kind of closely related to another theme, or maybe a part of that theme that's in the movie, which is, like, you know, the idea of the movie, the narrative context is that there's a tribe in South America that has this kind of, you know, exotic ayahuasca kind of like ceremony. And that's kind of how the whole thing starts. There's an anthropologist who goes there and spends time with this tribe. And then he brings this, you know, weird lizard monster back to Chicago. That's the story in a nutshell. I don't think we have to go into too much more detail about it. So, you know, we also have this kind of like remote exotic South American tribe that's very superstitious, again, very exotic. It's like so brief in this movie that it's not super offensive, but it is like, oh, great, like this thing again, which is in so many monster movies dating all the way back to King Kong. You have it in I Walked with a Zombie, Mothra, several other Godzilla movies. And again, it's kind of just like background flavor, I guess, that, you know, like there's not really that much depth to the tribe. We don't really know anything about them. But the movie kind of contrasts that tribe with, like, you know, the rigid science of the Dr. Green character, not to mention the sort of monetary impulse of the museum curators and the politicians who are desperate to get this opening night gala off the ground, even though there might be sort of a bloodthirsty monster lurking the hallways. So there's that contrast there too.
Yeah, I can throw it into the themes, that theme of these money people, high society, they're throwing this gala. It must go on no matter what the cost, right? And it's just this, sure, it's their livelihood, but it's still putting material matter and money over the fact that this is an active crime scene and people are in danger. They don't care about that. And this is not a criticism. It is another trope of monster movies. I immediately thought about Joe Dante's Piranha. It's the same setup. And there's countless other, I mean, Jaws.
Yep.
The 4th of July has to go off.
Alligator as well.
Yeah.
Another classic example.
I love that. It, to me, it's not a detriment. It's like, you know, your history and you're just continuing this proud tradition of murdering socialites at a banquet.
Yeah. Which is like an irresistible narrative trope. You know, I love it almost every time. And I think usually you can tell if a movie is using a cliche or a trope like that in sort of like a lazy way because they can't think of anything else, or if it's kind of like an homage, or just, you know, the filmmakers love monster movies and they want to like revel in that fun like we do in the audience, you know? And I think it's the latter with The Relic, where it's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be kind of like, you know, a tip of the hat to like classic monster movies that have come beforehand. So I agree with you. It's not really a detriment in this case.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Like the end of this movie is a lot of fun for sure. Aside from that, though, I don't know if this movie has any themes. Like it's kind of, like you said, proudly surface level. We can talk about the form and the aesthetic very briefly. I also don't have too much to talk about here in this case.
Yeah, but I wouldn't mind talking about this dark cinematography that you noted.
Yeah, it's super dark. I mean, not just like shadowy film noir lighting, but like black at times where like the entire screen is like, what is happening? I can't see anybody. I don't know where we are. Like there should be some shadow, some light somewhere so you can kind of get your bearings, you know, which makes me think that like it's not intentional. I feel like maybe this movie is just sort of poorly shot, which, you know, it's shot by the director, Peter Hyams. And maybe that was not the best idea. Maybe he should have had an actual cinematographer in this case.
I agree with you. However, it worked for me in the fact that it often served to keep the poor special effects hidden, which was a strength.
Yeah.
So I was looking out for that too. It's like, oh, okay, we're keeping the monster in shadow because the CGI looks like crap. So that was good. But you're still right. Like, all too much of this was just in pure darkness.
Yeah. Yeah, but you have a good point too, that it's kind of like, again, the Jaws style, where it's like, let's leave the monster off screen for like 75% of the running time. So when it does appear, it's like more impactful, which is kind of true here. But as you mentioned, the CGI, the bad CGI limits its impact a little bit.
But I wanted to see more of the practical effects of this suit, because I mean, even trying to find pictures of this thing online, there are no good stills that I can find because of the lighting situation. So, it's kind of weird in that way.
For sure. I mean, considering all the work that they went to for these like extremely difficult creature effects, I think we see it for maybe like less than 2 minutes in the entire movie, you know?
Yeah, definitely wanted more of that suit that they were working with.
Yeah. There's like one good shot where Dr. Green is like, she's in some kind of dark, shadowy room, like every room is in this movie. And like, there's like a pane of glass and we suddenly see the monster's face and like reflected in the glass. That's probably the best creature moment in this movie. It definitely looks like it's like a practical effect there, and it kind of comes out of nowhere. It's well lit and well shot. That's one of the few times that it's like, all right, I see the creature and it looks great.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the only time in this movie where you could say that. All right. So as usual on Camp Kaiju, we always have our individual breakdowns where we talk about the good, the bad, and the campy. Should I go first with the good, or would you prefer to do so?
I'll go first.
Okay.
The first note I want to say, maybe it relates to the aesthetic of the film and its genre. There were many parts of this movie that felt to me like a 70s disaster movie, like The Towering Inferno or The Poseidon Adventure, where this group of strangers are suddenly in a lockdown situation and they have to escape through some dark tunnel or other non-traditional ways to get out of the building, and the power's out and there's dripping water everywhere. Then there's the monster, which was very direct, and like it was also very Jurassic Park to me, which so many movies post Jurassic Park just leaned into whatever Spielberg was doing in that movie. So again, I don't fault it for that, but it was like Jurassic Park meets a 70s disaster movie, and I thought this is really unique.
It's funny you mentioned that. Roger Ebert said the same thing in his review, which is a really good, fun review. So check that out if you haven't read it yet, any of you listeners out there. But he made the same point. It's like a horror slash disaster movie, which is a lot of fun.
Yes, I knew I'm good at this stuff.
Yeah, you and Ebert. Like you were on, you're in good company.
What else? Okay, so yeah, I love the script. I love the premise, right? It's not trying to change the world. But like I've said this before on the show, I love a monster movie that's done really well. It's a tight script. Not all the dialogue works for me, but like the structure and the premise, it's cool. It works. It's done well. And I do like the design of the Kathoga, and I wish we could have seen it more.
Totally agree with everything you said, for sure. Yeah, like there are some moments where I think the Kathoga, you know, I mentioned that one shot that I liked. I also really like the scene where late in the movie, the police are trying to like rappel on ropes down into the museum, and everything goes awry almost immediately. Like as soon as one police officer like starts going down into the museum, the Kathoga just like jumps up and like sucks out its hypothalamus and like bites off this guy's head immediately, like within like 2 seconds. And then like things continue to go horribly awry. The creature doesn't look all that great during that scene, but just everything that's happening is like so entertaining, gory, fun, maybe not really all that scary, but just like a really good, fun, exciting scene. So I love that moment.
Yep.
I agree with you about the script. There is some bad dialogue for sure, but I think there are some like, unexpected moments of like personality too. There are two other police characters who I actually really liked a lot. It's a white officer and a black officer who seem like very good friends, and they debate coffee like in like numerous scenes throughout the movie. They're like, oh, you got to try lattes, like that's the way to go. And the other guy's like, espresso, man, you got to drink espresso. And then like they drink coffee later in the movie, and one of them is like, this coffee's terrible, don't even drink it. And it's just like, oh, I don't know why we're talking about coffee at this moment in the movie, but I kind of love it. So I like those moments of personality. I think Tom Sizemore and Penelope Ann Miller surprisingly have quite a bit of chemistry. Like you wouldn't think so from like just knowing about those two actors outside of this movie, but they play well off of each other, and that leads to kind of like a charming ending. So I liked that aspect of it. And yeah, kind of like you said, Vincent, like this movie seems like it loves monster movies, and it's trying to like duplicate these tropes from like the best monster movies, because it loves them. And like it's infectious, you know. We obviously love monster movies too, and that makes for a really entertaining experience.
That a beautiful summation. That's great. What do we? Yeah, I have nothing else to add in the good category.
Yeah, there is some bad stuff, of course. And you know, we talked about the CGI. It's kind of fun to see it in just like a time capsule way. Like this is what was seen as like top of the line special effects in the late 90s. They do not hold up, but and you know, they probably like weaken the impact of the monster quite a bit. But at the same time, I mean, it's kind of interesting to see them in retrospect.
Anything else?
The climax is really confusing, I thought. Like, you know, we're jumping back and forth between numerous different subplots. Like there's one police officer who's trying to lead all the socialites out of the building in these like dark, watery tunnels. But then there's also Dr. Green, who is being chased by the monster. And the monster seems to be in like several different places at once, like chasing these people in the basement and also in the science labs. It's like, but also they like closed the emergency like steel doors or whatever. So it's like, how does this monster get around so much? Like, it makes no sense.
I had the same note. Like, this monster shows up wherever it needs to.
Yeah. It defies logic. And normally I don't care about plot holes all that much, but in this case, it's like, this makes no sense. Like, where are we right now, you know?
That's awesome.
it's ridiculous.
Yeah, right. It's, yeah. They're like dumb quibbles, like, well, there's a lot of like one-liners that are said like wisecracks, but the mood of the scene is like very somber and serious, and I'm just like, you wouldn't make that joke. Why? It was just very jarring in many places where it tried to be funny, and I was like, don't try to be funny in this movie. You're doing a great job already just being highly entertaining.
Yeah.
But my big thing is also the climax, and there's a twist in this movie. And the twist is, spoilers, that the Kathoga is not only a mutated, extremely fast evolutionary mutant of a lizard, but it's also actually Dr. Whitney, who was that anthropologist in the tribal village at the beginning of the movie. And Dr. Green, when she makes this reveal, it's like, she acts like it's earth shattering, but for the audience, this reveal happens like 5 minutes towards the end of the movie, and we know nothing about her relationship with Dr. Whitney. We know nothing about Dr. Whitney. And I was like, I don't care about Dr. Whitney.
Yeah.
Like, this should be a great twist, but the script has done no legwork to plant those seeds. So it's just kind of like, oh, sure, that's a fine that's fine. But like, yeah, there was no payoff.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. It's confusing, and like to the extent that we do understand it, it's like, all right, why does it matter? You know, like, and it's weird because like there are numerous lines of dialogue where Dr. Green is like, oh, Dr. Whitney, you know, like I'm not a big fan. He only cared about his research or whatever. And it's like, that would have been a prime opportunity for you to say more about him. Like, what was your relationship with him? Why do you dislike him so much? But the movie never goes into that. So we, even though he is in the first two scenes of the movie, we know nothing about him. And it, yeah, that reveal does not matter at all.
Missed opportunity.
Yeah. It is kind of a cool idea that like, you know, because Dr. Whitney ingested this like fungus in like the opening scene, the like tribal ceremony or whatever, that's why like evolution goes awry and he like kind of merges with a reptile and like all this other stuff and turns into this monster. Like that's kind of a cool idea. But again, the movie does not really capitalize on that. Like it could have been way more effective than it actually is.
We're just talking about a different version of this movie.
Yeah. What could have been?
I'm happy with what we got, but I also would have been happy with maybe something that took itself more seriously, I guess.
Yeah.
For lack of a better word.
Something that was more carefully made, even if it also seems kind of like, you know, modest on the surface. You know what I mean?
Like a Jurassic Park. That is this version of the relic we're talking about, where it explores themes of evolution and science. So I guess we should just watch Jurassic Park.
Yeah. That's always the takeaway, pretty much. Like, yeah, if you watch a not great monster movie, just watch Jurassic Park afterwards. That's the best. Or, you know, like Jaws, like, you know, one of the classics. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, Jurassic Park is definitely the template and like the, what's the word, precedent in this case. So it is not as good as Jurassic Park, sorry to say. There's a bunch of campy stuff as well.
Yeah, there is. Do you know how many heads are lost in this movie?
Oh man, more than 10. It's in double figures for sure.
Yeah, I googled it. So everybody, the Kathoga kills by decapitating its victims, and there are 12 decapitations in this movie, many of which you see and are very graphic. And after, you know, the third or fourth, it started to become campy, like, yeah. Oh, there's another head rolling around.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of like in Sleepy Hollow, the Tim Burton movie, where like after the fifth or sixth decapitation, it's like, oh yeah, I've seen that before. Yeah. But it's great. I love it. Yeah.
It was super fun. Yeah.
And, you know, like Stan Winston's practical effects, maybe not so great with the creature, but they're great with the decapitations. Like there are all these heads lying around that are like, they have like big holes in the back of the skull and everything. It looks awesome. It's gory in the best possible way.
Yep. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah. What I think is the campiest part of the movie happens pretty early on, where like the two kids that are part of like a school field trip to the museum, they like stay there after hours, like after the doors are locked, they kind of like hide in a stairwell or whatever. And those two kids, they're just like, you know, they're child actors. They're not great, of course. And like their dialogue is pretty bad. There's not really any reason for them to be there because like, they don't play a role in the narrative after that. So that subplot could have been cut out entirely, but it is ridiculous. And they're, yeah, like those two kids are a lot of fun. There's one line where one kid says to the other one, "You goofball, you almost wet your pants." And for some reason, that line is like the funniest thing ever to me. I rewound that and listened to that like three times in a row. Those kids are great. Yeah. "You goofball, you almost
great." Glad we spent time with them.
Yeah. I'm glad I cringed while they said this dialogue for 10 minutes. Yeah.
And also, in what world are two kids left behind on their field trip to just like, they're there so late at the museum?
Yeah. Like terrible chaperones, whatever school they came from, they really need to work on that before their next field trip. Lucky those kids didn't get eaten by the monster, you know?
They should have.
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of fun stuff, a lot of campy stuff in the relic. I think it's time for our ratings. Do you think so? All right. As well? Unless you have anything else to add.
I have to add medulla oblongata. That phrase, that term, was uttered in Fiend Without a Face, and I failed to make note of it then. Medulla oblongata was mentioned in the relic. It is the third movie. I have heard that term. Do you know what the first or the other movie is?
That you watched kind of recently?
No, it's from the 90s. It's a comedy. It stars Adam Sandler.
Yeah, The Water Boy.
Yeah.
I do remember that. It's yeah. I don't always love Adam Sandler, but The Water Boy is fun.
Medulla oblongata. That's all I have to say. And the Repellers, when they go down into the museum, you mentioned it, but it's such an iconic moment. It should be. It's just pure chaos. And this guy gets severed in half. There's these poor guys. They go down. They're so confident. And then this really terrifying monster just goes nuts on them, and they're all screaming, pull me up, pull me up.
That's the best scene in the movie for sure. I love it.
Oh my god.
There's even a moment where they like pull a guy back up out of the museum on a rope, and he, of course, when they pull him up, they realize that he's been cut in half, or like bitten in half basically. And the guy that pulls him up like literally kneels down and like looks up towards the skies, and he's like, no. It's such a such a great cliched silly moment. I love it so much. I love that scene. I want to watch it again.
I'm sorry, man, you're right. That guy on his knees who goes no, it was this. He didn't have a director at that moment. He just did what he saw in other movies, in other bad movies. And it's just so amazing. It'd be like Tommy Wiseau. Like, that's what he would do in that moment.
Yeah. You're tearing me apart.
Literally.
Yeah, right. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, totally. And then, like, you know, the director, Peter Hyams, was like, oh, that's great. Let's keep it in there. Print it. That's gold. That whole scene is like just a what's the word I'm looking for? A bottle rocket of like great campy moments, you know? I love it.
I'm in tears, everybody. I'm in tears. All right. Yeah. So my final rating. You know, honestly, there are antiquated moments. There are some poorly lit moments. some poor 90s CGI, but I think it holds up. I think it stands the test of time. It may not be an overall classic, but I think it's a classic, an underrated classic, at least of 90s monster movies. I mean, forget Independence Day. The Relic is what you want to check out.
I love that review. That's great. Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, antiquated moments for sure. Bad CGI. But I really enjoy it. This movie's so entertaining. It's really fun. I think my favorite thing about it is that it's like a classic creature feature updated for the 90s. You know, it like again pays homage to them and like King Kong, Jaws, of course, Jurassic Park, which is not, you know, was only a couple years before The Relic, but I love that sense of like love for cinema and love for monster movies, and it comes through in The Relic. And even though the late 90s weren't that long ago, it still feels like a totally different time, and it's fun to revisit it in The Relic. So yeah, for me, it's not a timeless classic, but it does stand the test of time for sure.
Were there any sequels to this?
In literary form, there was like a whole series of books that followed. Like they're like the second one was called The Reliquary and like had some of the same characters in that book. But movie wise, there were no sequels.
Oh, that's too bad. I just feel like there are worse movies that got direct to video sequels. And I'm like, The Relic, there needs to be a Relic too.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's not too late. You know, let's write that script. We can do it. Now's the time. And probably like 20 people across the face of the planet would be like, oh, yeah, The Relic. I remember that movie. Everybody else would be like, what? What? What is this movie? Why are you making a sequel to this?
It's set in a museum. What?
Yeah, that Ben Stiller movie, right? Anyway, the Relic, a lot of fun. Check it out if you haven't seen it yet. Late 90s monster movies. Just a blast from the past. It's great. So yeah, next time we're going to be talking about an actual classic Universal horror monster movie, The Wolfman. So stay tuned for that. We'll also reveal our trivia winner on that episode. So The Wolfman coming out soon. So thank you again for hanging out with us at Camp Kaiju. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. Send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com, on our Facebook page, or on Instagram. The links are in our bio. If you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, please leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. Please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more information. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Minya's Mailbox music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thanks again, friends, and until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the bio.
7 decapitations in 1 week. Don't you just hate someone who only takes head and never gives it?
You're bad, Matilda. Real bad.
Autopsy attended by Lieutenant Vincent DeCosta, Chicago Homicide. We have an African-American male, probably age 55 to 60, height 5'4", with his head maybe 6'1", weight 160, give or take, if you know what I mean. The sternal process has been split and the rib cage exposed. Now for the head. The head is decapitated between the axial process and the atlas. The entire occipital portion of the calvarium and half the parietal process has been crushed, or rather seemingly punched through and removed, leaving a hole perhaps 5 inches in diameter. The skull is empty. The entire brain appears to have fallen out or been extracted through this hole. The brain is severely traumatized and appears to have been severed at the medulla oblongata.
That is correct. The medulla oblongata.
Mama said.
The medulla oblongata.